Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Switching gears a bit, we were talking about alternative care for pets, zeroing in primarily on dogs and cats, frankly, but there are a lot of wonderful exotic pets out there. And we had, I forget when it was, a month or two back, we had Dr. Kurt Sladke on. He's a clinical associate professor in zoological medicine and the section head of the Special Species Health Service at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. So he's with us today to talk about exotic pet care, exotic pet health, and certainly inviting your questions and comments when you join in. You may have a pet that's considered exotic. What do you have? What do you enjoy about it? Would you recommend it? Are you intrigued by the idea of an exotic pet? But maybe you're not sure about the kind of care it needs. So all those are great, great questions. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at the Larry Mueller Show. And we would certainly love to hear from you. And Dr. Kurt Sladke, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. And you brought something.
I brought a not the most entertaining radio guest, but I brought a Chilean red-legged tarantula with me today.
Oh, cool.
One of my own from my lab. And she was entertaining people out in the waiting room as well. And she is one of the many species that I work with. Work with anything from invertebrates to lions and tigers and beluga whales. So
you've been, yeah, and you are, you are board certified in zoological medicine. And we mentioned this last time you were on, but there are only about 130 vets in the whole world.
Right.
That are certified?
About 130 of us who have passed the board exam in zoological medicine, which is quite challenging. I actually train residents as well in zoological medicine, so I typically have two residents on my service that rotate between the clinical the clinics at the Vet Med Teaching Hospital and the Milwaukee Zoo and the International Crane Foundation, and we do some work with Vilas as well.
So it's a lot. What are some of the most common exotic pets that you might see at the vet school?
I would say nowadays, it used to be we'd see 50% birds, a lot of parrot species. Nowadays, we see an awful lot of rabbits and rats and guinea pigs as small mammals. We see a lot of the most popular reptiles tend to be bearded dragons and ball pythons. Mm-hmm. And then we see still a lot of parrot species. We also see primates, a variety of primates, and fish, amphibians.
Yeah. So pretty broad range, and there are a lot of them out there.
A lot, yeah. There are exotic pets. It's a booming field. And as you can imagine, pet fish are probably the number one exotic pet in terms of sheer numbers kept in households these days.
Sure. Well, Amy in La Crosse has a question for you. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I have two female guinea pigs that are 2 years old. We got them from a friend about all a year ago. And now for about a month, I was trying to figure out what was wrong with my one guinea pig, and it appears to be bumblefoot. I found that on the internet, and on the internet, there's a lot of conflicting views of if I need to actually take it to the vet to have some antibiotics, and then some people are like, oh, it just goes away, and so I was wondering if I could ask you about that.
Sure. We call it pododermatitis. It's a inflammation and sometimes an infection of the, usually it's the hind feet, but sometimes it's the front feet. It's sort of the bottom of the foot that is in the surface of the bedding. It's oftentimes one contributing factor is rough caging or rough substrate, and then the guinea pig walks around in feces and urine, and though the bacteria then embed in the foot itself. It's really it can become a pretty nasty infection, and the worst case scenario is the infection can get into the bone of the foot. And once it gets into the bone, that can be highly problematic. So I would strongly recommend that you have a vet take a look at the foot. Usually, depending on the severity of it, I will do maybe systemic antibiotics given orally, as well as I might actually open up, clean up the foot itself, depending on the severity of the infection.
Mm. All right.
There you go.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Amy. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Maybe you could post a photo of your exotic pet right there on the page. I'd love to see them. From your mind, what are the pleasures of having an unusual or an exotic pet?
I think I find that people who own exotic pets tend to develop this strong bond like you would expect anyone with their dog or cat. So we have a lot of rabbit owners and rat owners, for example, that just rats are fairly short-lived, unfortunately,
yeah.
But they're incredibly smart, and they develop a bond with their owners that I see as no different than a dog or cat, including the end-of-life issues of the sadness and that goes along with losing.
Yeah, and when maybe sometimes you have to end a pet's life. Yeah.
Right. And some people I know, I have several clients who are bird owners who have 40-year-old birds or 45-year-old birds, and they've been with them all their lives. Some of these species that we're dealing with are very long-lived and sometimes outlive the person. So they have spent so long with the animal, it's a part of the family.
Yeah, very, very. Could you imagine spending 45 years with?
Right. Or a 100-year-old tortoise. You know, some of the tortoises will live that long. So,
wow. Would a tortoise be unusual for you to have come to the vet clinic?
No, actually, we see quite a few tortoises. One of my recent patients was a 20-kilogram, which is about a 45 to 50-pound African spurred tortoise that needed surgery. So it's not uncommon that we see anything can come through our door on any given day. It's totally unpredictable.
What's the most unusual thing things that you've seen?
Well, we occasionally will have sort of owners of roadside zoos bring a tiger or a lion in to get evaluated. Like I said, we certainly see a lot of primates. The Racine Zoo brings us occasionally complicated cases that we've seen in the past, whether it's a penguin or a wallaby. And then I'll sometimes go to the Vila Zoo to work on some of the large animals when they have a procedure, a polar bear or a chimpanzee, orangutan, things like that. So.
Must be a fascinating job.
I feel like I've seen it all. and I guess the reason why I got into this field is because it's always something new. It's always unpredictable, and you never know enough. You're always learning.
Always learning. Our guest, Dr. Kurt Sladke, talking with him today about exotic pets and the care of exotic pets. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. We have some photos. I'll have to get those photos up on my Facebook page here. Sometimes I have trouble finding those photos of this.
That's our friend of the day.
That's the friend of the day, the tarantula that you brought, that's about the size of your hand. From the look of it.
Right. She's, exactly. That's my hand with the glove on, and she's actually quite mellow, as a lot of the pet tarantula species are quite mellow. They're venomous, and their venom tends to be similar to a bee sting, so if you have a hypersensitivity to the venom, it can be life-threatening for the most part, it's like a bee sting. So if you don't have that systemic reaction, it's a welt. They have fangs that are definitely. It's nervous when you get nervous when people see the fangs. So.
Paula in Racine, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Paula.
Yes.
I've got chickens, and I've lost a couple of this summer. Not sure why. They just kind of stopped roosting, kind of just withdrew from the flock. Couldn't find anything really that started it, and the other chickens were fine. But I've had a real difficult time trying to find a vet to treat chickens or someone to consult with.
Mm-hmm.
So can you give any recommendations on resources?
Well, we see actually quite a few. We have a chicken in the hospital right now. We see quite a few chickens. They actually are becoming more popular in the cities with the ordinances that allow three or so chickens in any given household. Sometimes when you have chickens dying, the best thing to do is as soon as they die, to get that chicken into somebody who can do a necropsy or an animal autopsy. That oftentimes will give us all of the answers we need to then deal with the remaining chickens. If it's an infectious disease that's transmitted through, that's kind of going through the whole flock, that's an easy way to sort of jump on it and try to control it and treat it. Sometimes it's a parasitic infection. Sometimes it's a virus. Sometimes it's easier to treat if it's a bacterial infection. But in living animals, it's best to see a vet who deals with chickens and can do some diagnostic work and try to determine it. Otherwise, I would strongly recommend if you have another chicken die in the very near future, sounds grim, but if that happens, I would get that chicken in to a vet who can do the necropsy and send the tissues off to a pathologist.
Okay, so in this case, would you be, Madison, be the closest place to do that? Or,
I would say yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure where else. And you're in, where? You're in Racine.
In Racine, and I've consulted my vet that treats our cats, and he said there is an exotic vet, I think, in Milwaukee area. That thought that might be a resource. So I guess I was concerned that it was going to go through the flock and then it was just an incident, one incident factor. So, I'm thinking it maybe was a virus or they're free range chickens and then they're cooped at night. And I stopped feeding the wild birds thinking maybe they were picking something up from the scratchings underneath the bird feeders as kind of a preventive thing. But I didn't think of that, but hopefully we won't lose any more, but I will keep that in mind.
All right, very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about exotic pets today and their health with our guest, Dr. Kurt Sladke, and he will be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Most of us have a doctor we see for checkups and when we're not feeling well, but many of us also use alternative medicines or therapies to keep healthy and to enhance some of the more traditional medical treatments. Might surprise you to know that some of these same approaches can be useful for our animals as well. And a lot of times we have may have exotic animals and it can work for them as well. We're going to be talking about exotic pet care for the next 30 minutes or so with our guest, Dr. Kurt Sladke, a clinical associate professor in zoology, zoological medicine, section head of the Special Species Health Service at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have him along. He is a clinical associate professor, and his incredible range of experience and depth of knowledge in the care of exotic pets. So we're really glad to have him to be with us today. If you have questions for him, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And Darcia will get to you in just a second, but Dr. Slatke, maybe you could talk for a minute so people know about the services, the range of services that you offer at the vet school.
Well, we're a teaching hospital, which and we're very similar to something like University Hospital in a smaller form. We have all the specialty services at the vet school, including our service, the Special Species Health Service. So we have immediate access to it. You know, if I have an animal that comes in with an eye problem and we can't quite diagnose the problem, we have an ophthalmologist that can come over and take a look at it. Or that's true of if we have an animal with cancer, we can consult our oncologist. So we have the ability to do an awful lot right kind of immediately there. We do a lot of unique things, like we use endoscopes to do dental procedures in small rabbits and mm-hmm. other small rodents, so we can take before and after images through a camera for client education and client use. And I think one of the things that scares people the most, exotic pet owners the most, is anesthesia and sedation. And we actually, for every animal that gets sedated or anesthetized in our service, there's an anesthesiologist right there to work the anesthesia. So it's very different than a private practice where, and I've been in private practice, where we're oftentimes doing it all ourselves.
Yeah. So a really broad range of services there at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Darcy in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was in the car and I heard the previous caller talk about the problems with her guinea pig's feet.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to share something that I did with my guinea pig that prevented any foot problems. So I found all this information online. There's a lot of, it's really easy to find if anybody's interested in it. But instead of using wood chips or bedding or hay bedding, I use synthetic polar fleece layered over towels. And the towels absorbed any of the urine through the fleece, and then the little guinea pig turd stayed on top, and I could just sweep those up or vacuum those out every day, and it stayed dry, and I just laundered it once a week. And it was a really soft bedding, so he never had any problems on his feet. And when I took him into the vet, she actually asked what I was using because she said she'd never seen such healthy feet before.
It's
a very clever solution.
That's a great solution. So just to go through it once more in case people missed it. So you put...
You go to the fabric store and get polar fleece.
Polar fleece.
Yep. Not sheep's fleece, mm-hmm. but synthetic fleece. And then you can either buy some new towels or some old bath towels that you have. Layer those first in the pan of the cage, and those absorb all of the urine. And then layer the fleece on top. And that'll wick the moisture through so it feels dry on top. And then the moisture is held below.
When you first
get the fleece, you have to wash it on hot and dry it a few times to get rid of any of the sizing. Otherwise, if you use it brand new from the store, the urine will just sit on top and won't be sucked through.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. It's a great solution, isn't it?
Thanks, Darcia.
Yeah.
It is certainly unique. I don't think I've had any client with that solution before to keeping guinea pig feet healthy.
Thank you again. An email from Dave in Horicon. We have one ferret. Should we have two of them? Do they need to have other ferrets around?
Well, that's a really good question. And ferrets are social animals, and if more than one is in a house, they love to play together. However, as with any species, whether it's a dog or a cat, when you introduce a new ferret into your house, are they going to get along? So the question is always, which you won't know until you add that ferret, are they going to get along? But to be honest, most people with multi-ferret households, the ferrets just love to play with each other, and they're very entertaining. And that keeps them out of some of the mischief. When they're a single ferret in the house, they get into an awful lot of mischief because they don't have the entertainment from another ferret. So that's a great question.
And Linda in La Crosse, we are on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a redfoot tortoise, and she's about, I'm not really sure, like maybe 7, 8 years old. And when I got her, she seemed to be walking fine. But now when she walks, it's like one of her rear legs kind of collapses underneath her each time she steps on it.
Mm-hmm. So is your tortoise kept inside and outside or put outside in the summertime at all?
I just take them out and then bring them back in.
Okay, let them in the sun for a little bit.
Yes.
So typically in a single leg lameness in a tortoise, we want to take an X-ray of that leg. And sometimes it's a musculoskeletal issue, so it's sometimes a fracture or sometimes it's ligament damage. They may have gotten their foot caught on something outside and tried to pull it and damaged it that way. We also typically see or fairly commonly see gout in the joints, and it's just like gout in people, and it's essentially sort of associated with what they've been fed all of their lives, but not some animals are just susceptible. So an X-ray will show us, joint damage, bone damage if there's a fracture, or gout where you can actually see mineral in the joints themselves.
Okay.
And then sometimes it's just an infection, that there was a wound on the foot. Bacteria got in the wound and crept up and are creeping sort of upward in the limb. Sometimes, again, the infection will get in the bone, and that can cause some real problems. So, but an X-ray will help with that as well. So that's the first step. Get to a vet who sees chelonians or turtles, tortoises, and have them take an X-ray.
Awesome. Okay, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot. Now, I suppose you have to sedate like a turtle if you're going to do an X-ray.
Turtles and tortoises are a challenge because their immediate reaction to me as what they view as a predator is to pull all their limbs and head in, and there's not much for a physical exam there. So we typically do have to sedate them, maybe a minor sedation just to be able to take an X-ray, get a blood sample, kind of do the typical diagnostic routine that we might have to do.
Pam and Marshall has a comment for you. Pam?
My concern is that I've seen on nature shows and other shows people that have snakes, and they keep them in plastic, it looks like Tupperware containers that are probably 5 or 4 feet long, maybe at the most, and not very high, and there's really nothing in there but a snake, and they have shelves and shelves of those. How can that be, like, even humane? I don't understand how people can keep snakes like that and not have it be against the law.
Yeah, that's you bring up an interesting ethical dilemma, I think, that we all face with pet ownership. A lot of snake breeders will keep snakes in smaller plastic rodent cages and shelves, and interchange their males and females for breeding purposes. Obviously, the more complex environment you can create for an animal, the better off the animal is. So, in terms of humane care, snakes like places to hide. Snakes like a relatively large enclosure. So a hiding spot and a large enclosure, substrate, water, maybe branches so they can get stimulated and by sort of natural behaviors. Those are all ideal. Leaving them for life in a Rubbermaid container is not particularly appealing as a veterinarian to hear stories like that. But there are no laws preventing people from maintaining snakes in that sort of environment, unfortunately.
Hmm.
Yeah, thanks. I just, when I hear the word exotic, that's the first thing I think of. And I love snakes, but I would never have one as a pet because I think it needs more room. But thank you for your information.
That's a sensible comment. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And on that note, Genevieve in Madison says, I'm really fascinated by reptiles and amphibians, but I've never had one as a pet. Is there a type that is a good starter pet, and what kind of care do they need?
I would say, just off the top of my head, the two best starter reptiles. Amphibians are much more difficult and tricky, but in terms of reptiles, bearded dragons are an omnivorous lizard. They eat a lot of fresh, dark leafy greens, so a little bit of fruit, and insects. And they're fairly easy to maintain, and they're, for the most part, non-aggressive. So that's one lizard species. If you're interested in a snake species, it would probably be the ball python. Ball pythons are probably the number one pet snake species we see now. They don't grow to be giant. They're called ball pythons because they're oftentimes you'll find them. They'll wrap up in the palm of your hand into a ball, and they tend to be fairly non-aggressive. They tend not to strike a lot, and with handling become quite gregarious and easy to deal with. So, bearded dragons as the lizard, ball pythons as the snake, and give me a call sometime if you want to talk about amphibians. It's a little more complicated.
All right. Our guest today, Dr. Kurt Slatke, you can join in with your questions. We have open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. But just talking about snakes, I was trying to think back to an issue where a young member of a family became ill because they were, I think they had a snake, and the youngster was handling the steak and got something off the snake.
Some salmonella is probably.
Salmonella.
So one of the things we try to educate owners of reptiles and amphibians is that salmonella is commonly, I would say not commonly, but it's a, reptiles carry this particular bacteria. And salmonella, most people hear of salmonella poisoning in the news from contaminated vegetables or a variety of other things. And it causes a pretty nasty gastrointestinal upset, diarrhea, vomiting. And if it infects somebody with a poor immune system, it can be life-threatening. And so we try to instruct all reptile amphibian owners to wash their hands, have their kids wash their hands, or wear gloves when they handle their animals, just so as not to transmit that bacteria. Now, from a practical standpoint, the literature that the published literature would say that probably the riskiest animals would be aquatic turtles. But even those, probably less than 20% are regularly shedding the organism. So, but it's an important zoonotic disease, or a disease that gets transmitted from animals to people. It's an important disease to recognize if you're a reptile owner.
Josie in Sheboygan, turn to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. I was wondering about ferrets. I've had a few in there. I just love them. They're so sweet. But I was told once by a veterinarian that they're very susceptible to different diseases. And also I was wondering how healthy are the ones that come from these farms where they breed and breed, and then they're sold in pet shops. That's where I got the ones that I had. And, also I was wondering how endangered, did you see on the TV, if you deal with beluga whales, that little one that they found? It was on the news, and they were trying to rehabilitate it, and they didn't know what happened to its mother. I mean, I heard that when they wash up on shore, that they are so toxic, they're handled as if they're toxic waste because of the pollution in the ocean.
Yeah, so let's talk beluga whale real quickly. Beluga whales are a species that... in the St. Lawrence Estuary, where many of them live, it is one of the most polluted aquatic environments in the entire world. And when they beach themselves, there's usually some reason, whether it's an infectious disease or a sonar blast in the bottom of the ocean, or that would be any whale or marine mammal. So when they do wash ashore, they're oftentimes difficult to rehabilitate or to get back in the water, and end up dying or having to be euthanized. And then veterinary pathologists look at the organs and try to determine what caused the stranding. Back to your ferret question. Ferrets are great pets. We see fewer of them than we did 10 years ago because ferrets tend to develop three different common tumors: adrenal tumors, pancreatic tumors, and lymphoma, which is a sort of a blood cell, a tumor of the blood cells and the lymph system. And so a lot of people find that when they purchase ferrets, the ferrets end up having to have to go to the vet fairly frequently. And then their lifespan is not very long. It's anywhere from 5 to maybe 9, which would be very old, with an average of 6 or 7 years. But they do develop a number of tumors, and there are ways of dealing with that. But you know, it's a balance. They are such a fun species to have as a pet.
Yep. There you go. Thank you, Josie. For calling. And Ken in Black River Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Ken.
Yes, very interesting show. I just introduced myself by saying I believe I have the world's record for spending $92 on enemas for a leopard gecko.
Oh.
You don't have the record. I could give you even greater cost for enemas in reptiles.
Well, it's very interesting. It was eating the substrate and becoming impacted.
Mm-hmm.
And the book I was reading on what to use for the substrate was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So we got that corrected, and then it lived for a while longer and then eventually succumbed to natural causes, or whatever is natural for a gecko anyhow. And it's really something. You know, you can't just let an animal die, because the same creator that made me made it, and you don't just let it sit there and suffer.
You are describing a common problem with reptiles, and some of the misinformation that's either published on the internet, published in books, or told to you by pet store employees, and that is, what substrate should you keep in a particular species of reptile on? And many of them will eat that substrate, and you experienced a very common problem, and that is obstruction by some sort of foreign body, which is the substrate. You might have been using sand. I've seen animals swallow marbles. I've seen them swallow stones, wood chips, you name it, and can cause problems. And then you're dealing with sometimes surgical procedures to alleviate that obstruction. If you were able to help your gecko with enemas, that's great. $92 was well spent.
Well, I lucked out, because one of the things you have to ask the veterinarian when you're bringing in an exotic sort of animal, he's exotic to me, is what's your experience. And it turned out that the vet up there at the Osseo Clinic, and I worked in a pet store, and I'm quite familiar with the problem, and this is how we deal with it. The other thing is, I am always amazed when I go to a veterinarian that deals with a variety of types with one species, just dogs, for example. And the ability of a veterinarian to be a good diagnostician is always awesome to me. It leaves me feeling that I might as well be discussing my own problems with the vet, because they need so little verbal information and are such good observers. And that is a real gift. I mean, it's just a wonderful thing. Every vet that I've met has been a really good internist, and my hat's off to them.
A lot of it is just that. It's that we are trained with patients that can't tell us what's wrong, and so we become very, I think that as vets, and if you have vet students talk to med students are always absolutely blown away by the knowledge of vet students and how empathetic they tend to be, because they're not, med students tend to can focus on one species and vet students mm-hmm. can't.
Well, another thing I've noticed is that veterinarians are more inclined to consult with other veterinarians. when they have a problem. My dog had something, I can't pronounce it, it was polycythemia, I don't know what it is. It looked like she was having a problem with red blood cells.
Polycythemia vera, probably.
That was it. And I was concerned, so I went as an undergraduate to Penn out in Philadelphia, and I was concerned. I called up Penn and got probably the world's expert on it, some fellow, I believe, from Switzerland, who was more than delighted to talk to my veterinarian about the problem.
I think you're right. I think we're just, it's the way we're trained. When you don't have a patient that can't tell you the problem, you have to dig and dig and dig and dig sometimes to find out the cause. And we sort of develop that way.
And thank you very much for calling. Ken, I really appreciate it. We're about out of time here. Nice comment from Kristen, who says, Dr. Slatke has treated my hedgehog in the past. The UW is very good at helping come up with solutions to novel problems. And since hedgehogs aren't common pets, there can be many novel problems. He's done fantastic work, and I highly recommend the UW veterinary medicine team. That's very nice.
Very nice. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you, Dr. Slatke. I hope we can have you back again.
Thanks, Larry. I appreciate being back.
Dr. Kurt Slatke, Clinical Associate Professor in Zoological Medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Thanks to him, and thanks to you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.